Let's call this meeting of the House Finance Committee to order. Let the record indicate that it is exactly 2:30 p.m. on Tuesday, March 31st, 2015. Present today, we have Co-Chair Representative Newman, Vice Chair Representative Sadler, Representative Edgman, Representative Munoz, Representative Pruitt, Representative Wilson, Representative Guttenberg, Representative Kawasaki, and myself, Co-Chair Representative Thompson. Before we start, please turn off your cell phones. They interfere with the recording equipment. Rep. Sadler. On today's schedule, we have our second hearing of House Bill 68, and we will be taking public testimony on House Bill 68. And if it is the will of the committee, I intend to move this bill today. We will also have our first introductory hearings on House Bill 143 and House Bill 135, time permitting. I do not intend to move either one of House Bill 143 or House Bill 135 from committee today. Our first bill today is House Bill 68, an act relating to the preparation, electronic distribution, and posting of reports by state agencies by Representative Christ Tompkins. We do have a finance CS before us, Representative Newman.
Mr. Co-Chair, I'd like to move committee substitute for House Bill number 68, finance version 2929-LS0352/I. Dated 3/24/15 for committee referral and discussion.
Seeing no objection, we will have the CS for HB 68 version /I it before the committee for discussion. Ms. Pearson, would you please come forward to the table, place yourself on the record, and explain the differences between version E and version I.
For the record, my name is Jane Pearson, staff to Representative Steve Thompson. There are two changes to this bill. They can be found on page 3. The first is lines 16 through 18, and this was to hopefully give a little more clarity onto where these reports could be found. It reads, a report produced and distributed by a state agency shall prominently state the Internet website where a digital copy and a physical address where a printed copy of the report may be found. The second change is, again, on page 3, line 24. It used to read that a person may obtain at no charge up to 4 printed copies. It now reads 2. Some of these reports are very large and could be quite cumbersome. So it now is 2 reports. And those are the two changes in the CS.
Okay. And I thank you very much. Here to present House Bill 68 is Representative Christ Tompkins. Representative, please come to the table, place yourself on the record, and briefly give us a recap of House Bill 68. And also, Representative Gaddis and Representative Guerra have joined us also.
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. For the record, Representative Jonathan Christ Tompkins. As Ms. Pearson spoke to the changes, this bill still effectively digitizes state reports that are currently printed in great abundance and rather significant cost to the state of Alaska. I think it effectively brings our method of dissemination of state information and reports into the 21st century. And I appreciate Representative Sadler and the transition language that was added, which I think makes the bill better and builds on work done in the previous committee. And I'm here and available for any questions.
Okay. Also, committee, we have we got quite a few people here that are available to answer questions. We have Arnold Liebert, Policy Analyst for the Office of Management and Budget. Megan Kearney, Librarian 3 for the Library, Archives, and Museum. Linda Thibodeau, Director in the audience, Director, Alaska Division of Libraries and Museums. Bob Banghart, Division of Operations Management, Libraries, Archives, and Museums. Department of Education and Early Development, Sarah Fisher-Goad, Ted Leonard, John Springsteen with ADA and the Alaska Energy Authority. Oh, wrong bill.
Every agency that's going to produce a report, they're all...
Oh, yeah, I was wondering, why are these people here? Does the committee have any questions for Representative Christ Tompkins? Representative Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Welcome to finance.
Yes.
So I don't think we had much of a description of the bill, why we need it, and how important it is. Could you tell the committee about the bill and why it's an important piece of legislation we need to pass?
Absolutely, Mr. Co-Chair. I mean, I think first and foremost, the bill is projected to save the state about $500,000 a year, which is, of course, a small decimal point relative to what we need to work towards, but nonetheless, every little bit counts, which is a mindset that I'm certainly committed towards. The bill is important in that I think it effectively increases the access Alaskans will have to public information, and that it standardizes the means by which annual reports and state reports are available to the public in an online means, and it also creates sort of a standard for digitization and archival of these reports. And through the process of learning what seems like all there is to know about state reports and state annual reports, you know, there's a, sort of a couple of on-the-side changes that I think sort of have a housekeeping quality to them. For instance, you know, on the first page, this is really tangential, but, you know, maybe worth mentioning, we increased the number of reports that are archived from 4 to 5 because the Library of Congress needs one, the University of Alaska Library System needs one, the State Library System. Anyway, just little changes like that that sort of got added on as we worked with the State Library and other people who work on this. But the basic takeaway is this digitizes state reports, saves the state money, and it standardizes the means of access, digital access, for Alaskans to get this information.
Another question.
Follow-up, Representative Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Chris Tompkins, what about people who don't have Internet? They should also have the access that everyone else in the state has as far as state reporting goes on that. So what concerns do you have about people who do not have the Internet access availability? I'm quite sure that there's more than a few of those in your districts and outlying areas who don't have availability to that, who tend to read the papers quite a bit, you know, because that's their access to it. If we don't have public radio, other means of communications like that because of budget scenarios, what about all those people who don't have the Internet access or other means of access to understand what's going on with their state government? What about those people?
Co-Chair Newman, through the other co-chair, I think it's a great point, and I do represent a district, as you mentioned, that has a number of people that fit that description. To me, this bill is all relative. It's relative to the status quo. So right now, people who live out in the sticks, you know, I mentioned the
On an island.
I mentioned a couple in the last committee hearing. You know, right now their access to information is effectively nil because they can't drive to a library. The state is not currently mailing them a copy of these reports, and they don't have Internet access. So in a relative sense, nothing's really changing for them. And it's however, I mean, we wanted to make sure to fortify the language and the provision in law that anyone who wants a hard copy can call up the state library system or mail the state library system and get a copy of whatever report they might be interested in or feel is important. And so we worked with Representative Keller and the State Affairs Committee actually to make sure that language was strong and that access to information was well protected, which is currently provided for, and we actually sort of enhanced that language, I think, a little bit in this new bill. So it's sort of creating parallel paths. If you really want a state report, if you really want some information, you can go through it online, and we're kind of standardizing that system and making sure it's universally available. But if you don't have Internet, which is a reality for a lot of people, it also creates an ironclad way to get information analog through paper and like this, and you can get it in the mail the old-fashioned way, which is, you know, just as important to protect.
Mr. Chair, if I may.
Go right ahead, Representative Newman.
Just to follow up on that, you said if people don't have the access to this, that they can send out in a letter or send in a request to say get it. If they don't know it's there, how can they send in a letter asking for it?
Representative Newman, through the other co-chair. I don't know what the etiquette is here.
Representative Newman through the chair.
Representative Newman through the chair.
Sir, etiquette?
I I think right now those people might be in the same situation. I mean, the person you just described, you know, currently does have some access to, they could call up the state library or mail the state library and say, we want this report. But right now, under current law, if they didn't know that they could call the state library, I mean, I guess that's just a problem. But I don't know how this bill or any bill could solve that. I mean, all we can do is make sure that if people want access to information, that's protected and provided for. I mean, certainly this bill does not inhibit that ability for anyone. I mean, I guess we could incorporate it into curriculum potentially in civics class or no. I mean, but you know, the resources available to you as a citizen. I mean, if you want, you know, the state library works for you and is committed to getting you the information you as a citizen are entitled to. But I don't know how to solve that problem, and this bill doesn't attempt to, although I would like to make more Alaskans aware of the rights they have to public information.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I know that the representative wants to make sure that we have an open, accessible government to all peoples of the state. So I just wondered what thoughts he had on some of those issues. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
From the discussion, it sounds like a lot of these people we're speaking about don't get a copy mailed to them at this time, but this is putting information out where they'll have more accessibility to getting a copy, even though they don't get one at the present time. Is that correct?
I think that's an accurate description.
Okay. Representative Sadler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Christ Tompkins, I appreciate you accepting my amendment. I think that will help bridge the advance of civilization from paper to digits. But I heard you claim that a $500,000 savings. I was trying to see where that was located. The fiscal note from the executive branch says the savings would be inconclusive and that the total report printing expenses for agency reports is $585,000 a year. So can you tell me the basis of your claim for $500,000 in savings?
Yeah. Representative Sadler, through the chair, I think we addressed this point a little bit in the previous hearing, and that the savings that are projected are ultimately going to be kind of inconclusive. I think it's very safe to say it's going to be a negative number, but the scale of which is unclear. Originally, OMB provided a number in the $400,000 range for the cost of total state reports printed, and then they accounted when they calculated that number and provided that number is before they were able to take account for reports printed by DOT. And that kicked the number up to the $570,000 figure. Of course, because this bill allows commissioners and department heads to say, this report is really important and it needs to be printed and not automatically digitized. Not all those reports are going to be digitized, so there still will be printing costs. And I think the fiscal note speaks to this as kind of inconclusive what proportion of those reports. I mean, I think DMV and ADF&G are kind of the obvious examples in that they – you know, it's nice to have those pamphlets and brochures, and I'm sure the commissioners will invoke the authority that is provided in this bill to say these are important to have in hard copy and make available. So we're kind of guessing. All we can say is it's going to be a negative number. I'm just sort of operating around the number that OMB provided, but I think you're right to point out that it is indeterminate ultimately.
Representative Munoz.
Well, thank you. Thank you, Representative. I appreciate you bringing the bill forward. Just one question on it's a printing question. Often when you print a four-color publication, your costs for printing just a few copies are pretty close to printing hundreds or, you know, many hundreds of copies. So the requirement here to print a few copies, is it your understanding that it would be for the types of reports that we're used to seeing, or would it be simply a Xerox copy of the online version?
Representative Munoz, through the chair, that's a good question, and it may be better, the folks from the libraries may be able to better address it, but I think I can give a good sort of gander at what the answer would be. And what I think actually might be the most important language in this bill is not the requirement for sort of default digitization, but actually the requirement that these reports and annual reports be done in-house and that you don't hire graphic designers for tens of thousands of dollars to produce these really gaudy Christmas card-like reports that all of us have received in the mail. And instead, you know, you just do a simple, just the facts, ma'am kind of report that gets the data and the central information and is done in-house. And I think, and speaking to Representative Sadler's question, that it's the savings of that language are also not calculated, and that would, I think, further enhance the negative number associated with this bill. So it's just another reason why it's an indeterminate fiscal note ultimately. But the takeaway from that is if these state reports are indeed simple, just regular PDFs that, you know, you or I could print up if we wanted to, I mean, ultimately, you're not going to need a printout, so you can just print it on any old printer because they're not going to be these fancy four-color holographic hologram translucent, you know, Christmas cards that we sometimes get in the mail presently. Or that's sort of my process of thinking, but again, I think the folks from the library system could answer that more exhaustively if desired.
Well, and I just wanted to put it on the record that I think the intent is to obviously to save costs so that as we go forward, the use of a Xerox copy of the report makes sense and not, you know, going through the effort of printing a four-color copy report and then having, you know, a dozen or so copies available of the report, because that really wouldn't save, you know, the dollars that you're anticipating.
Representative Moody is to the chair. That's agreed. Yeah.
We do have people from the Division of Libraries, Archives, and Museums in the audience. If there's any questions you'd like to direct to them.
I just wanted to get that on the record that, you yes. know, that we would have, you know, the intent, I think, would be to go to a Xerox report and not, you know, not the full-color operation.
Representative Kawasaki is next.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thanks for the presentation of this bill. Certainly some of us are more savvy on computers than others and electronic forms of media. This committee, unfortunately, doesn't allow for electronic forms, just to point out the one thing. I'm looking at the Ledge research report on the state agencies that are required by statute. A lot of those state agencies are required to report to the legislature in a form. And I think we just discussed another form that we wanted to get a report reported to us on another bill. I'm curious if the language in this text would then supersede all future agency reports to come to us electronically versus in a printed form.
Forgive me, Representative Kosicki, through the chair. Could you restate that question?
So, thank you. Through the chair, Section 4 deals with the distribution of agency reports. And so if we pass bills in the future discussing, like we just recently passed the one on indirect expenditures. That's a physical report. We got a copy of it. If that bill were to pass today, would this Section 4 supersede the requirement for that to be sent in a different form, I guess?
Representative Kawasaki through the chair, I think it would. It would qualify as a state report. My expectation of what would happen is what some agencies have already elected to do, which is, you know, for us as legislators, there are statutory requirements that certain reports be distributed to the legislature and to legislators, and we receive an email once a year from the leg liaison or whomever saying, such and such report is online. Here's the link if you want to look at it, FYI. And some of those agencies have, you know, declined to produce physical copies of those reports on their own initiative, you know, for whatever reason, cost saving or otherwise. And my assumption is if there are state reports that are statutorily required to be disseminated to the legislature, it would simply be electronic dissemination, which I think we've already seen to some extent through those emails that I just described. So yes, I think it would supersede, unless, of course, the division had felt that there was, you know, a high and clear public need that a hard copy be produced and given to legislators, for instance, and in which case that would happen. And it's worth noting that we did a little bit of diligence after the previous committee hearing, and division head includes the governor, the lieutenant governor, and also you know, includes the legislative branch. And so if there's a report produced internally within the legislature or something coming out of Division of Elections or the governor's office or whomever, that the appropriate entities in those departments or branches of government could still produce a hard copy if they felt it provided a marginal benefit.
Let's follow up.
Follow up, Representative Kawasaki.
Thanks. I guess just my only, and I these are the reports that we've received in the last couple days. So if you want them, you could have them. But just, you know, my only concern is that the decision makers, the ones that are critical decision makers like we're supposed to be, get the right reports, and that the administration doesn't decide that out of whether it's convenience or price tag or whether they just don't want us to see the information, can just hide that in an email. I got about 20 emails supporting Representative Munoz's bill in the last 10 minutes. I could feel my phone vibrate. And so I would have lost an email that says, oh, hey, by the way, there's the new spring forecast report is out. Here it is if you want it. Is there a way, you know, the other thing is I don't care about the State Fire Marshal's review on cigarette fire safety report that's due every 3 years on January 30th. I don't need a paper copy of that. I guess, is there a way for the legislature to opt in to say these are reports that we definitely want versus definitely don't need in paper? I guess the only, because otherwise we're looking at these emails. I got hundreds of emails in the last couple of days. I would miss a report that I ordinarily might not if I'm sitting on the floor going through mail and saying, oh, this is a report that's important.
Representative Kawasaki, through the chair, I'm not sure I have a solution for that one. I can certainly relate to the email deluge, courtesy of Ms. Munoz or whomever. Representative Munoz, forgive me, or any legislator that has an exciting piece of legislation. I have to say I can relate to a similar problem with mail to a certain extent, too, in that, you know, I get my stack of mail, and just as with email, you kind of have a dazed and confused look on your face as you're going through it, trying to, you know, sort out what's important from, you know, what you simply just don't have time for. But I think the short answer to your question is no, that there isn't a mechanism to sort of have agencies highlight what is important and what is not. And I mean, also, it would seem that, you know, for some legislators, certain reports would be important and certain reports would not. And, you know, it'd be difficult to suss out consensus what, you know, everybody wants and, you know, what's trash to one person is treasure to another, I guess, and that might apply to some of these reports that we get in our email or mail.
Thank you.
I wanted to point out page 3, line 20, last online public notice system, AS44.62.175, fulfills any obligation in state law to publish, prepare, or present a report, and electronic distribution fulfills any obligation in state law to submit a report.
Okay.
Next we have Representative Guerra.
Oh, I'm sorry. I thought
you had your hand up.
I was happy to learn that we're supposed to have etiquette in committee. So.
Okay.
Oh, and then the one question for the sponsor.
Follow up? Okay.
Yeah. Are people allowed to co-sponsor this bill?
Representative Guerra, through the chair, yes, okay. As long as that's not contrary to House finance etiquette.
Thank you.
As long as you don't publish it. So. Okay, seeing no further questions at this time, I'd like to open House Bill 68 up for public testimony. Is there anyone in the room that would like to testify? Seeing none, is there anyone online? We have some members online that says that's on the wrong bill again. Nobody online? Nobody else here in the room? Seeing no further questions, I'd like to close public testimony. Any further discussion from the committee?
Not sure that was legal, Mr. Chair.
Kinder, gentler devil.
At this time, I would entertain a motion to move CS for HB 68 version I from committee.
Mr. Co-Chair, I'd like to first congratulate Representative Chris Tompkins on, I think, his first bill this year through finance, or maybe his first bill. Well, welcome. So anyhow, Mr. Co-Chair, I'd like to move committee substitute for House Bill Number 68, Finance, version /I from committee with attached individual recommendations and fiscal notes.
Tomorrow's first. April 1st, we can object tomorrow.
No objections? Seeing none, we'll take a brief time out while we sign the paperwork. We're back on the record. The next bill up today is House Bill 143, an act authorizing the Alaska Industrial Development and Export Authority to issue bonds to finance the infrastructure and construction cost of the Sweetheart Lake Hydroelectric Project and relating to legislative approval of loans from the Power Project Fund to the Lynn Canal Transmission Cooperation Corporation and the City of King Cove. Bill is by Representative Munoz. We do have a CS before the committee. Representative Newman.
Come right up. Here, I'd like to move committee substitute for House Bill 143, version 29LS0599/E, before the committee for discussion purpose.
Seeing no objections, we will have the CS before us. Here today to present House Bill 143 is Representative Munoz and her staff, Crystal Coneman, who will speak to the Sweetheart Lake Hydroelectric Facility portion of the bill, and Representative Bryce Edgman's staff, Adam Berg, who will speak to the Waterfall Creek Hydroelectric Project in King Cove. Ms. Coneman and Mr. Berg, please come to the table, place yourselves on the record, and begin your presentations.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. For the record, my name is Crystal Kieneman, staff to Representative Munoz.
Oh, hi. Yeah, Mr. Chairman, Adam Berg, staff to Representative Edgman.
So what we have before us, House Bill 143, does a couple of things. First, it provides legislative authority for ADA to issue bonds to finance the infrastructure and construction costs of the Sweetheart Lake Hydroelectric Project, and also for ADA to loan from the Power Project Fund for both the Lynn Canal Transmission Corporation and King Cove Waterfall Creek Hydro Project. A little bit of background, the Sweetheart Lake Hydroelectric Project is located here in Juneau, about 30 miles south, and the Federal Energy Regulatory Agency has accepted the Juneau Hydropower's license application, and the project is now in the EIS process. The new facility will provide Juneau with an additional 116,000 megawatt hours, increasing Juneau's current electric or energy capacity by 25%, and it will create roughly 85 new jobs. It will also provide new recreational infrastructure and fishery enhancements for the community, and provide and protect and enhance the Sweetheart Creek personal use sockeye fishery. The Lynn Canal transmission proposal would include about 35 miles of transmission line from the existing Lena Cove substation to Kensington Mine. It would consist of both of overhead, underbuilt, and submarine transmission lines. It aligns with the CBJ resolution expressing support for the extension of the electrical power along the Veterans Memorial Highway, as well as the Southeast Conference's line-to-mine resolutions.
Mr. Berg.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the King Cove Waterfall Creek Project, statute requires legislative approval for a loan from the Power Project Fund once state involvement exceeds $5 million. And Waterfall Creek Project requires an additional $1.2 million as of right now to advance the construction. That amount would bring the total state involvement above that $5 million threshold to $6 million. So that's the reason we ask Representative Munoz to allow us to put this into her bill. And there's a one-sheeter in your packet that explains the Waterfall Creek Project, but the highlight is it's fully designed, permitted, and construction bid ready. If this legislative approval goes through and they're able to get the loan from AEA, the end result would be King Cove will have the capability to produce over 75% of their power with hydro, which is a really big deal with power costs, remote areas. So any questions, I can try to answer them.
And one last thing, if I may. The authorization provided by this legislation for not only the ADA bonds but also for the AEA power project does not guarantee completion or going forward with these projects. They still would need to go through the financial, economic, and technical feasibility studies and due diligence analysis. And after that, they still need the Board of Directors approval to move forward with those.
Okay. For the committee's information, we also have available to answer questions online is Ted Leonard, Executive Director of ADA. See Nick Sajmonik with ADA, Sarah Fisher Goad, Executive Director of AEA, Wayne Zagarlik from the Core Kensington Mine, and we also have Gary Heine, City Manager of King Cove, and Wayne, yeah, that's all of them. I tried to get all these people to testify on 68, but I guess they didn't want to. Representative Newman.
Thank you, Ms. Co-Chair. I guess folks testifying on behalf of this legislation, when I'm looking at the fiscal note, it says, although House Bill 143 provides AEA with required authorization for a loan, the Power Project Fund does not have a balance sufficient to fund a $22 million loan. The Power Project Fund currently has approximately $13 million in uncommitted funds. Without additional funds, AEA would be able to provide a loan for approximately $9 million. So how do we do this when the Power Project Fund would need to make another, would have to have another $22 million? Where is that supposed to come from?
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. The way that the Power Project Fund works, absolutely correct. There would need to be additional funds put in there. There are, as the loans are being paid back from other projects, that money will go back into that fund. So there would be additional monies available for that.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Newman.
Ms. Kahneman, it seems to me that if they don't have the funds now, and if they're depending on other funds to come in there to replenish their deficiencies, because that would be caused by this legislation, that other projects that may have to need the same priorities and criteria needs around the state would not have an equal chance. You know, there should be enough money in these funds, I would think, to be able, not that these aren't important projects, but it just doesn't seem to me that if they don't have the funds there, how can we do this, and how can we sit there and say we're going to depend on the incomes that are becoming in the payments onto these funds. We're financing out into the future money that we don't have, and I think it could put it to jeopardy other projects from other communities around the state that may also have probably higher costs for electricity, you know, or types of energy that can be coming from these funds. How are we supposed to deal with that, or how are we supposed to look at those issues?
Understand your points, Representative Newman. There are additional private funds that would be utilized for this. The loan would be up to the 22. It does not necessarily mean that it is specifically for that 22 million. They are working on private investments. This gives them authority. So if the fund does become solvent in the next few years, or if there is additional revenue that does come to the state for energy projects, then this gives them the authority to do so. But I do understand your concerns about other projects around the state.
Perhaps Sarah Fisher-Gold, Executive Director of AEA, is online. Sarah, could you possibly address Representative Newman's concerns?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Sarah Fisher-Gold, Executive Director of the Alaska Energy Authority. As we described in the fiscal note, and what we've done in the past is, although the legislation is authorizing a greater dollar amount, we would anticipate working with the applicant when we do receive an application to look at a smaller loan amount. With respect to construction, we'd also want to make sure that the rest of the financing plan is in place in order for the project to move forward and to participate at least with the partial power project fund loan.
Any follow-up, Representative Newman?
Mr. Chair, my question, I think, was more to the reference of other projects around the state, future projects that may require access to these types of funds, the power project fund, for other energy needs around the state, maybe other areas in the state who would have considerably higher energy costs. Interior Alaska, it's very expensive for energy. We're now subsidizing them with power cost equalization through that PCE fund to help reduce their costs. And would this short the fund for other communities that are also trying to apply for funds out of this program into the future?
All right. Further questions? We have Representative Wilson, Kawasaki, Guttenberg, and Guerra.
Thank you.
Oh, go ahead. Excuse me, Sarah.
Sarah Fisher-Gold, could you respond to my question?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and through the chair to co-chair Newman. That's actually with the fiscal note. What we tried to do is take into consideration the balance, the cash balance of $13 million. What we put in the fiscal note is we had anticipated a $9 million loan would be potentially available. Now, I will note that that is before the work draft and the potential King Cove loan. And so, again, what we've tried to do is to work with the applicants where we wouldn't want to drain the fund in order for us to be able to provide loans for some of the smaller communities and utilities that have applied for loans. And so we're very much cognizant of the fact that this loan fund is being used for more projects. We actually just approved a very small loan for Pilot Point to do some diesel generator repairs. And we've done another one for Quigilingok for a small community for diesel engine repairs. So we are trying to take that into consideration to make sure that all the loan funds are not loaned out, and that we would have an opportunity for some of these smaller projects to be able to come in the door and to be able to receive financing.
Thank you, Mr.
Chair.
Thank you. Next, we have Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I have a couple questions. But the first one is, since this one already found a writer, why couldn't we include the Interior Energy Project into this bill? Well, you knew I had to ask.
You don't need any more money.
Roll House Bill 105 into it, you mean?
Yeah. You could call it that. I mean, we're already talking about two energy, you know, projects, so what, you know, what would be the issue? Would there be a problem with that?
I think there would be talking completely different projects. Any follow-up question?
Okay, well, it has to do with energy, so I will take that somewhere else. But anyway, I'm not too sure where, though. So on the King Cove project, I don't know whether or not they're currently receiving power cost equalization. If so, will this project have a positive impact so that more than just the small amount that they get for power cost equalization, will this project lower their bill substantially?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, I don't know exactly how much it would lower their bill, and Sarah Fisher would probably have a better answer than I would on that. But yeah, it would lower their power costs, which would conceivably make their PCE payment less.
Let's ask Sarah, are you still there?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is Sarah again. They do receive power cost equalization. I'm not certain of what the impact would be, but I will have to say with the community of King Cove, they've actually been very proactive with their development of hydropower costs and, in fact, have some of the, although eligible for PCE, do have some of the lower rates in some of the rural communities because of the hydro that they currently have. In fact, I think in the past, when they've applied to the Renewable Energy Fund, because of our emphasis on higher cost areas, they're really right on that cusp of looking at needing loans to help finance this additional Waterfall Creek project. So I apologize, I don't have the specific PCE dollar amounts in front of me, but my expectation is that this would. In a long-term case, be very beneficial to the ratepayers of King Cove.
Well, if we could get the information, Mr. Chair, because I think as we look at these projects, I think we need to look at, especially since this fund doesn't have a whole lot of money into it, being able to see not just what it can do for some of these projects, but if we can also make it so that these communities are more self-sustainable, especially with, you know, how we're doing right now fiscally, I think that should play a role in how they determine where the money goes. Thank you.
Okay, next we have Representative Kawasaki.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is actually for Sarah. On the Power Project Fund, on the fiscal note, it mentions that the fund has only $13 million in uncommitted, unencumbered funds. Does that mean that there aren't any other projects that are before AEA to consider, or does that just mean that you haven't expended those funds for other projects that could be in the queue?
Through the chair, Representative, we do have, I believe, a couple applications that are pending that are not listed. Actually, it looks like it's just two projects that are pending that are not. Oh, I apologize. We actually are considering those as part of the available balance. So we have just a little over $13 million of uncommitted loan fund balance. So we do have some projects that that are committed to use funds that we can't loan those funds. So the cash balance is a little bit higher in the fund right now due to loans and projects that are still working their way through other requirements. For example, we actually have a fairly large one, the Reynolds Creek hydroelectric project for HIDA Energy is a $20 million loan that has been approved and committed in the program. So we actually have a much higher cash balance, but that is a committed loan that we would not be able to issue a new loan for those cash dollars.
Thank you. And Sarah, when we when we first started the Power Project Fund and we started adding money in and taking money out, the loan amount says not to exceed a certain amount, and So we've had a lot of these projects across the state, and we found this is a great pot of money to use. I guess are there times where AE wouldn't authorize the entire loan amount, and for what reasons would those be?
Through the chair, representative here, we actually had something similar with the city of Sitka. They had received an authorization for, I believe at the time it was an $18 million power project fund loan, but we were actually in the same situation that we wouldn't want to loan and drain the fund for that total amount. They were actually able to receive a slightly better interest rate with the Muni Bond Bank and chose to finish financing their project through the Muni Bond Bank rather than through the Power Project Fund. So we have made arrangements with other potential borrowers and applicants to make sure that we do, you know, maintain the loan fund. And in the past, we've received other appropriations. We, in 2010, we sold the loan portfolio to ADA to receive a cash infusion of the fund. We received a $10 million appropriation into the Power Project Fund. And then Cordova Electric for the Humpback Creek loan had a $10 million authorization specifically for that. That is one of the other alternatives for specific projects to receive a Power Project Fund authorization is through an appropriation.
Okay. And then, Mr. Chair, I have a question for ADA, but I can wait if we're going to get him up later.
Okay. We do have quite a bit of work left to do today, so we are going to be bringing this bill back for further public comment also. I have Representative Guttenberg, Guerra, and Sadler, and then I would like to set this bill aside and move on to the next. Representative Guttenberg.
Mr. Chairman, if I can yes. make one request before we move on to the next item today, if we could allow a few minutes for Mr. Zagarlok from Kensington Mine to speak to the issue. He's been waiting online. And
okay.
Thank you.
Let's go to Representative Guttenberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For Sarah. First I want to say the Interior Energy Project just needs authorization to change the way it's going to use the money. You got 100,000 people sitting in the middle of the state paying the highest utility rates in the nation for anybody sitting on a road system. I don't know what's holding up that project, but I think it could roll into here easily if the will was there. But I don't know about this bill either. But Ms. Goad, what is the cost, the BTU current cost, not the BTU, the kilowatt cost in these communities now, and what is the expected reduction in kilowatt costs? Or if that's not the issue, what is the issue on doing these projects? What is the savings going to be for the ratepayers?
Through the chair, representative, I guess with respect to King Cove, I'm looking at the King Cove power cost equalization. The last rates in fiscal year 2014, their effective residential rates were 23 cents a kilowatt hour. The average, that was after a PCE rate of 8 cents per kilowatt hour. To have to work with the community of King Cove. With respect to what this loan would do in the completion of this project and what their expected rates would be. So I did, similar to, I think, Representative Wilson's question, we will provide some additional information to the committee with respect to anticipation there, but we would have to work with the city of King Cove to really kind of determine that. And I guess... Mr. Chairman, we do not have an application for we do not have a power project fund application for the transmission system in Southeast Alaska, and I think it may be beneficial to hear from the project proponent with respect to that, because I think that's a little bit of a different project and not, I don't think, serving existing AELNP customers.
Okay,
Mr. Chair. So you, is this project advanced enough for normally where projects are advanced enough to this point in development? It doesn't sound like it.
Through the chair, Representative Guttenberg, we currently do not have an application for the transmission project before the power project fund, so we have not done any of the analysis with respect to that project. But I do know it is closely linked with the Sweetheart Lake project that's also part of this bill.
Thank you.
I'm going to go ahead and go to Wayne Zagarlik, Coeur, Alaska. Representative Munoz wanted to have you make a statement, Wayne.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. Coeur, Alaska, Kensington is a gold mine that's situated approximately 45 miles north of Juneau. The operation has approximately 320 direct employees and approximately 40 contract employees. The mining operation, including processing and camp living facilities, consumes approximately 8 megawatts of electrical power to support all of our associated activities. This power is currently supplied by 7 diesel generators. The cost to generate this power, including fuel and maintenance, represents, on average, 12 to 15% of our operating cost. Energy represents our second biggest operating expense behind labor only. It's our belief that hydroelectric power is a means to significantly reduce the cost of electricity at Kensington and increase the sustainability of the operation in the process. To that end, Coeur, Alaska has entered into a letter agreement with Juneau Hydropower. The essence of the letter is that Coeur, Alaska has committed to negotiating a power sales agreement with Juneau Hydropower once the terms of an agreement can be identified. In addition to that, I am the sitting chair and president of Lynn Canal Transmission Corporation, which is a nonprofit entity designed to provide open, non-discriminatory transmission line services to the Northern Lynn Canal at the lowest possible cost. And, of course, that's a very supportive effort for Kensington.
Yeah, Wayne, if you would please state your name and your affiliation for the record.
Certainly. Wayne Zagarlik, Vice President and General Manager of Coeur, Alaska, Kensington Gold Mine.
Okay, thank you. We have other questions from Representative Guerra.
Sure, just I don't really have a problem with the bill at all. There's a lot I just need to understand. And I just do have one question for Mr. Zagaroff. And it's just so the loan will go to the Lynn Canal Transmission Corporation to interconnect the Kensington mine. And you said that only applies to the Northern Lynn Canal region. Are there other major users that benefit from the Lynn Canal Transmission Corporation, or is that something that's designed for the Kensington mine?
No, I do believe there are other supporters of the transmission line along the way. I mean, there's certainly residences along that path that currently don't have power, as well as other landowners that have, you know, wishes to develop but are kind of hamstrung by the lack of electrical power.
If we could get the bill sponsor to possibly give us how many, some numbers in there, you know, we're trying to, as Representative Guttenberg talked about, we have 100,000 people in Fairbanks that are paying 24 cents per kilowatt hour at this time. And we have several mines up there also. Next question we have is Representative Sadler, and then we're going to have to move on.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think this is for Sarah Fisher-Goad. In some of the background material, it indicates that AEA does plan to go ahead and do the due diligence necessary for the Lynn Canal Transmission Corporation loan, regardless of passage of this bill. But in AIDA's language, or in its letter in support, it says it would not proceed without authorization under HB 143. Help me understand that discrepancy. How much would AEA propose to expend to do that due diligence in the absence of authorization from the bill?
Through the chair, Representative Sadler, I am confused. What are you reading?
I'm reading a letter from that you signed, dated March 16th, that says, independent of the legislative authorization and upon receipt of a PPF loan application, AEA will complete project due diligence analysis of the financial, economic, and technical feasibility of the project. And I emphasize independent of legislative authorization. So I'd like to know how much that would cost and why you would do that.
I apologize. Through the chair, Representative Sadler, I don't think I worded that particularly very well. What I wanted to emphasize in there is that even with legislative authorization of the loan, we would do a due diligence effort that the authorization of the loan does not make the loan happen, that the due diligence would be an independent effort. So I do apologize. That was not an intention. That was a poor wording on my part.
Okay, so you don't mean regardless, or in opposition to. Okay, good. Very good. Okay, and a second question, I guess, I would ask maybe both you and anybody who can answer the question here. I understand from my time on the Energy Committee that there is a Southeast Alaska Regional Future Energy Plan. How do these two projects fit into that? Do they fulfill that plan? Are they in opposition to it? Do they supplement it? Who remembers the thing I'm talking about? I'll take a lifeline.
What was that?
I'll let Sarah answer it. She funded it.
Sarah?
Through the chair, Representative Sadler, I honestly would have to go back and look at the Southeast Integrated Resource Plan to see if this project and the transmission line were specifically addressed in the Southeast IRP. I apologize that I don't have that level of detail at my fingertips.
If you could get those to us, we'll get it distributed.
In that regard, the integrated resource plan met some consternation in the region because it recommended moving to wood burning stoves and whatnot as the primary source of generating energy. So I wouldn't rely on the outcomes of that study to draw any conclusions with this project. This project is supported by the Southeast Conference, which is a regional entity of communities and businesses, as well as the City and Borough of Juneau, and many business entities as well.
All right. Thank you. Representative Pruitt.
On that point, and I think it's because that's a really important piece, because that's what I remember to say. It was the report basically said Southeast is going away, and so burn wood and everything will be fine. And I think if I recall in the conversations that I've had with the individual who is supporting this, that there's the potential that this would also assist when it came to, because there's potentially some excess energy, it would help with either the fuel oil or that wood burning discussion in the Juneau area. I think that's probably another little piece that might be good to highlight there. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chairman, it is correct that this project would increase our hydroelectric capacity by 20% and would directly impact rate users in a positive way by extra generation of power and most likely reduced rates as well.
Okay. Would the sponsor like to make any final comments before we move on? Representative Edgman and Representative Guttenberg do have another question, but we'd like
I know time is of the essence here, so I'll be quick. We didn't get to hear from the King Cove City Manager, Gary Hennig, who could speak to that project at length during our next hearing.
Yes.
If that's necessary, because there's more to add to that story. But the other point I would make is that I think both these projects very ably meet the objectives of the Alaska Energy Policy that was passed in 2010 that identified the Power Project Fund as the primary source of funding and did talk about business development and affordable rates for consumers and things of that nature. So maybe we'll get a chance to get more in-depth into that as well.
All right. Representative Guttenberg, and then we'll move on.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to point out that more communities around the state are going to and considering biomass, especially isolated communities off the grid. Certainly Southeast has a lot of biomass. Tok has a huge project going on for biomass for heating its schools and its and power for its communities and community gardens, other places around the state. Take some of the stress off of transmission lines. The biomass is there just like the water's there. So we need to be doing smart things. And sometimes the traditional things are not smart, and sometimes they are.
All right. Sponsor, like any final comments? Thank you very much. At this time, Representative Munoz.
If I could just make one
you're
comment.
The sponsor.
In response to Representative Guttenberg, I in no way mean to diminish the benefits of biomass. that clearly very important. And we have many projects, biomass projects, that have been successful here in our region, including Sea Alaska, right here in Juneau, generates their heat with biomass. But the recommendations of the Southeast Integrated Resource Plan talked about converting much of our region to biomass, which in a region that is so prolific with water resources, it didn't really fit our model, if you will. I mean, certainly it's part of the solution, but it's not the solution.
Thank you. At this time, I'm putting House Bill 143 aside. Our final bill today is House Bill 135, an act establishing a Roth contribution program for the public employees' deferred compensation program and providing for an effective date. This bill is by the governor. Here to present House Bill 135 is John Boucher, Deputy Commissioner, Department of Administration, and Kathy Leah, Chief Pension Officer, Retirement and Benefits. Please come to the table, put yourselves on the record, and begin your presentation.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, I am not John Boucher. My name is Andy Mills. I am the legislative liaison for the Department of Administration. And here with me is Kathy Lee, Chief Pension Officer for the Division of Retirement and Benefits. My apologies, Deputy Commissioner John Boucher had a 3:30 in Senate Education for another bill that he was going to go down for. So my apologies, he could not join us. We are here today to talk and introduce the legislation on behalf of Governor Walker. Before you today for your consideration is House Bill 135. It's an act establishing a Roth contribution option for public employees in the deferred compensation program. In general, this legislation would empower plan members to take control of one portion of the retirement portfolio, namely the timing of the taxation of their contributions. Right now in the deferred compensation plan, it is a pre-tax option. You will pay tax on it at the time that you receive those contributions at the time of retirement. This allows for another deferred compensation option that is post-tax. You will not pay tax in the future when you receive those contributions. The reason generally for that is then you can mix your pre- and post-tax to hit a certain threshold that you're looking to in your retirement when you have those contributions coming back to you. Interestingly enough, by way of background, the current statute that we have on the books comes from 1973, and the statute currently only allows for deferred compensation to be made on the part of a pre-tax option. But Congress in 2011 passed legislation that enabled governments to provide this Roth 457 option to public employees, and it's effectively just another option for public employees to further diversify, make choices for their own retirement needs, and it's in essence just another deferred compensation option. Certainly Kathy Lee is available to step through a sectional, and we're available to answer any questions for the committee. While there's no simple bill, this is only three sections, so I've been told that.
Mr. Mills, the post-tax contribution to this can be withdrawn without taxation, but the earnings on that fund would be taxable still, I'm sure, correct?
Mr. Chairman, I'll turn to Kathy Lee.
Ms. Lee, place yourself on the record.
Okay. For the record, my name is Kathy Lee, and I'm the Chief Pension Officer with the Division of Retirement and Benefits. The objective of a designated Roth contribution is that not only are the contributions made, they're made on a post-tax basis, but the earnings are not taxed on distribution if they meet the qualification rules. And those qualification rules is that the Roth contribution account has been in effect for 5 tax years and the member is age 59 and a half.
I wondered why my wife did that as an offer, Roth. She's a CPA. She knows what she's doing. Questions by the committee. Representative Guttenberg.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. This is an interesting one. I'm trying to digest exactly how it's working and the difference between just doing it in the private, just taking your contribution, post-tax contribution, and using it in the private sector. What's the benefit of doing it through the state?
Through the chair, Representative Guttenberg, the designated Roth contribution differs from the private sector IRA in that it takes on the characteristics of a deferred compensation plan. So the total amount that can be contributed is greater than what can be done in the private sector. There is no income requirement to be able to participate in the plan. You just have to have a salary from which we can take contributions. Those are essentially the major differences between the two as far as making it beneficial to have this for state employees.
I'll just follow up.
So what would be the maximum contribution? Would that equal to your after-tax salary?
Through the chair, Representative Guttenberg, the maximum contributions for deferred compensation are $18,000 a year. And that comes from your salary. And with this bill, it would allow the employee to determine whether or not they wanted to sustain the taxes now on their contributions or later. They can contribute both pre-tax and post-tax. We are required simply to account for those differently.
One more, Mr. Chair.
Follow up, Representative Guttenberg. So
is there an expected rate of return? I mean, I know you want to have the most, I mean, we all want to have the most rate of return on our investments, but in a program like this, there must be a target or a number that they can assume or try and assume that they're going to reach.
Through the chair, Representative Guttenberg, this is not an investment option. Mm-hmm. It is simply a taxation option. The investment vehicles in the deferred compensation plan as currently constituted would remain the same. So the return would depend on how aggressively the employee chooses to invest and what the returns on those investments are.
So those are my investment options. Okay, thank you.
Ms. Lee, you said that the maximum is $18,000 a year. Is that you mean pre-tax and post-tax, total of $18,000?
Yes, Chair. It's $18,000 in total, and it can be a combination of pre- and post-tax.
All right. Representative Newman, do we make that much? Go ahead.
I have to ask my wife.
Mr. Chair, you know, as former Representative Richard Foster mentioned to me one time, you know, new legislation tends to just go back and fix old legislation. So when this was initially set up for these contributions, why wasn't it set up this way?
Through the chair, Representative Newman, in 1973, when the deferred compensation plan was established, an after-tax contribution was not contemplated. That only became available on January 1st, 2011.
Follow up.
Nope.
All right. Thank you. Representative Guerra.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to state for the record that I'm not at all nervous that both of the finance co-chairs' wives are running their finances. and I would like to note that the fact that the co-chair from Fairbanks' wife knows what a Roth is, but he didn't, adds to the list of reasons that I've noted in the past that you're very lucky to be married.
Thank you. Thank you. Representative Sadler.
No, sir.
Okay. Oh, I thought it was okay. Representative Pruitt.
Yeah, thank you. So so it almost sounds like we're getting a little bit into a kind of a financial advisor role from the state in terms of, because when you have the outs, right now, if it's anything that's the after tax, many times people will go to a financial advisor. I guess one of the concerns I'd have is that now that we've got I would say that most individuals are probably not savvy on the IRAs and stuff. That's why you use the financial advisor. But now we're going to take on an additional role where there's if we have specific amounts in this IRA, the Roth IRA we have, it could impact the amount that they could put into other IRAs and whatnot. My question stems of how do we figure we will be able to communicate the information to our employees that now might be able to take advantage of this without them getting into trouble. Right now we don't have anything that you can really get in trouble from the state level, but this could potentially get them into trouble if they're not savvy enough to recognize or communicate that to their financial advisor.
Okay, through the chair, Representative Pruitt, a contribution to a designated Roth contribution in a government 457 plan does not prevent a person from also contributing to a Roth IRA in the private sector.
Oh, okay.
So we would have no nexus there. Also, the plan does provide some financial education and advice through its record keeper and through advised assets, and the employee can take advantage of that whether they want to or not. It's not a requirement, but it's available to them if they want to take it.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm sorry, I misunderstood you earlier. I thought that it was part of that full contribution. So it sounds like this is separate. That sounds good. No, I'm saying I misunderstood. I was wrong.
Mr. Mills, do you want to reply to that also?
I just also wanted to add that through the chair, Representative Pruitt, their investments are highly personalized. You make a lot of investment decisions based on your level of risk. And as a personal note, in my mid-30s, I am looking at what the tax liability might be in the future with a federal deficit that is growing, and that might give someone concern, and I might say, I would like some post-tax options now because I have the certainty of the taxes now, and I would like those in my retirement portfolio so that later on the exposure to that potentially higher liability is mitigated. And that, for me, is about empowering employees with options.
Representative Sadler, then we'll be having to move on.
Thank you. No, just briefly, it's more of a statement than a question. I do know what a Roth IRA is, and I think we all hear Roth and immediately fill in IRA. So this is not a separate investment option. This is not a separate liability of the state. This is simply a different vehicle, a different separate way to manage your deferred compensation account, either pre-tax or post-tax. I was going to ask you why it was only available after 2011, but upon closer examination of the background, I see that's what became available. So.
All right, Mr. Mills and Ms. Lee, I do thank you very much for today. We'll be having you back again. I've been wondering what my wife is doing with my money. At this time, I'd like to set House Bill 135 aside.
I am so concerned.
Roth is
the at our next House Committee meeting, which is scheduled for Wednesday, April 1st at 1:30, the meeting will have our second hearing of House Bill 158 and House Bill 41, and our first hearing on House Bill 13. And at 3:40 p.m., we are adjourned.